This is about how can we create a scenario whereby it's actually more affordable to make the goods that we consume whilst also not doing it at the cost of our planet. Understand the old playbook, know why that was the way of doing things, but also look at the cards in front of you today, build your business accordingly with them. There was a lot of, for me, of focus on energy management as opposed to time management. I was always like, how can I be as productive as possible? A mantra that I now live a lot by is dare to be average. I'm a recovering perfectionist, and if I had the time, I probably would be a perfectionist.
Welcome to the Dangerous Woman podcast, hosted by me, Sophie Norris. This podcast claims the Dangerous Woman mantle one incredible, dangerous businesswoman at a time. And our Dangerous Women Collective is a community of professional women where we celebrate our achievements, support our successes, and champion our contributions to the world of work. This podcast gives a voice to those who break boundaries, from combat helicopter pilots and global CMOs to medical innovators, leaders, survivors, and creators. Every story is raw, real, and fearless. Dangerous Women share their tales of derring do to inspire and engage everyone who recognizes the power of Zig versus Zag. This collective is not anti-men. It is 100% pro-women, pro-power, pro-progress. If you are ready to stand shoulder to shoulder with women who are rewriting the rules, this is where you belong. This is what you should be listening to. Why be old when you can be dangerous? This podcast is hosted by Sophie Norris, co-founder of the Dangerous Women Collective, and is sponsored by ESET, providing next-gen digital security for home and business. We dare you to listen. Today, I am delighted to introduce you to Georgia Ware, a dangerous woman who has made the move into the world of startup and entrepreneurialism. Not only that, she is moving into the oft male-dominated world of engineering and climate tech. And this is no mean task. It is a relatively, though not enough, well-known fact that only 2% of all female founding teams receive investment money. This plummets to just 0.4% when it comes to funding an all-female-founded climate tech project. Today, Georgia is CEO of Hot Green, an industrial heat pump startup that is out competing steam boilers with a green heat solution. She became passionate about industrial heat and its enormous client impact whilst in her previous role as the head of growth and partnerships at Hexcel, an hybrid AI software company focused on optimizing the maintenance processes for industrial heat transfer equipment. God, I don't think I've ever sounded so technical in my life. Amazing. She previously led a healthcare startup as CEO in the early stages of its development in 2020 before it closed in 21. And she started her career in management consultancy, spending 5+ years at Oliver Wyman, leaving as a senior manager. All of this achieved before Georgia is 35, though listeners, I've just learned she's only 32, so even more amazing, showing that age really is just a number, and that in a world largely created by men, women are very much part of its future creation. Interestingly, Georgia and I also went to the same all-girls school, though about 20 years apart, I'm sad to say. But I know, though privileged, our school teaches its pupils and alumni that they can be anything they want to be. Glass ceilings didn't seem to exist there, and the sky was the limit for all of us. It will be interesting to find out how much of an influence her early education had on Georgia, because I'm sure her master's in manufacturing engineering from Cambridge certainly did. And before we launch into our conversations, a quick shout out to Keith McCambridge, a mutual friend who introduced us. You were the second guest I've had on, thanks to Keith. It's great that Dangerous Women have some pretty powerful male friends out there too. I'm sure you'll agree. So I thought we might start, Georgia, with your journey to today. How did we get to Hot Green?
Absolutely. And firstly, Sophie, thank you so much for having me on the show today. I'm so excited to be part of the Dangerous Woman community. So huge thanks on that one. And yes, a massive thank you to Keith McCambridge as well for setting us up. He's continued to be an amazing champion for me, both whilst he was my boss and actually beyond. So shout out to him.
Yeah, he's a good chap, is Keith. Yeah,
he's a great chap. The overview of Hot Green, how did it come about? I suppose it started with my desire to really have an impact in terms of mitigating the worst impacts of climate change. I think most of your audience is likely aware that we are heading into a pretty bad and miserable future when it comes to our climate. I think the thing that gets me the most angry, really, the most sad, is in terms of how unfair, how deeply unfair it is. We're in a situation where 10% of the global population has caused about 65% of the greenhouse gas emissions that are causing climate change. And actually, the top 1% of emitters cause about 16%, which is equivalent to the same amount of emissions that are produced by the bottom two-thirds of the global population. And that's something that just feels so deeply unfair, right? I often think about it, if you had a tombola and you put, you know, a huge giant tombola, you put all the people in the world in it and you pulled out 100 names and you brought them into a room and you looked around you and you were like, wow, look at this incredible diversity of individuals, of ages, of languages, of cultures. And you had one individual who was producing the same amount of carbon as two-thirds of the room, we wouldn't think that was okay, especially when those two-thirds of the room are the most likely to be the most impacted by the worst impacts of climate change, which is heavily impacting agriculture, which is heavily impacting low-income communities that don't have that same financial resilience when disasters strike. And so as a result, yeah, I deeply care about trying to have an impact on that journey. What's Hot Green got to do with it? Well, about 3 years ago, I started looking into industrial heat. Up until that point, even though I'm a nerdy manufacturing engineer and I love to know and understand how things are made, I'd thought very, very little about the heating processes that occur in industry. Industrial heat collectively is 20% of global emissions, which is crazy because it's something that you never hear about. I think those that have started to, you know, show an interest in climate, or even those that aren't that aware, they think about climate, they're like, oh, okay, electric vehicles. Maybe the more sophisticated are looking at things like sustainable aviation fuel for our airlines. And actually, industrial heat, 20% is more than all of transportation combined. It's actually more than all of the emissions of, I think it's the United States and India.
Wow.
So it's a huge amount of global emissions. And yet it's something that people don't think about. I call it the elephant in the climate tech room. There's this opportunity that exists to solve this problem, which has been systematically underserved by innovation to date. It has potential to have a big impact. And so for me, I saw this and I was like, gosh, this is so exciting. Like, how do we actually address and solve this problem and start to decarbonize industrial heat? Something that I also think really exciting about industrial heat is not only it's, you know, 20% of global emissions, it's a massive opportunity. It's in the fabric of all the goods that we use and consume on a daily basis. You know, to bring it into like reality of where do you actually see industrial heat? Because for most of us, we're not walking the factory floors of these industrial sites on a day-to-day basis. If you were to go into the Sainsbury's supermarket down the road from me and you were to look into most of the middle aisles, most of the products that we consume have gone through some form of industrial heating process. So for example, the milk that I poured on my cereal this morning was pasteurized using a heating process done up to 80, 90 degrees to pasteurize the milk. The beer that I'm going to the pub, it's a Friday when we're recording, so I'm going to the pub tonight. The beer that I'm going to drink has gone through a brewing process, which is again a heating process. If things get really wild and we get onto the whiskies, whiskey is distilled. And all of these processes are using fossil fuels today. And the list goes on. I mean, you've got the paper that you consume, the chemicals, the pharmaceuticals, enormous amount of the products that we use. And we're not going to stop using those products. I don't want to give them up. I don't want to stop having a pint on a Friday night or using paper, or I don't want to not wash my hands because I don't want to use the chemicals in my soaps or clean my flat, although that sounds a bit more debatable. The reality is we're going to continue using these products. So how do we start to get rid of those ingrained emissions that are ingrained in them through the processes that are there? And then this is where I get really hopeful. So there's actually some really good news. So we've talked about, okay, 20% of global emissions industrial heat. And that industrial heat actually looks into your sort of low, mid, high grade. So there's some really high temperature stuff that's really hard to decarbonize, but there's some awesome new innovations that are looking to do so. But actually for the lower temperature stuff, so you know, the beer brewing, the milk pasteurization, which are going up to about, you know, maximum kind of 200, 250 degrees. There has been for 150 years a solution that can decarbonize this heat. And that's roughly about 8 to 10% of global emissions. So cool. job done. Don't need to be on the podcast then. We have a solution. Bye. Yeah. We have had a solution for 150 years, which can decarbonize 10% of global emissions. And that solution is industrial heat pumps. They already exist. We've heard a lot about, you know, your listeners probably have heard about heat pumps in a domestic case. It's similar technology in a different context and often going up to much, much higher temperatures than what you would see in your homes. The challenge is, and the reason that they've not been adopted to date is they're really expensive. They're expensive to buy, they're expensive to run, and they fundamentally can't outcompete fossil fuels in the majority of geographies because gas, which is the fossil fuel of choice for most industries, is really cheap to burn. And it's really easy to burn as well. My co-founder and I created Hot Green last year with a really simple idea. Can we make industrial heat pumps affordable? And in fact, so affordable that you would get rid of your existing gas boiler altogether. Because something else that was really important to us was every day at the moment, more boilers are being installed in industry that are going to last 25 plus years. And there's no way we're going to realize our 2050 targets if those boilers are still running, still burning gas, still emitting carbon into the atmosphere. And so as such, you know, we have that ambition to be so affordable that you would actually get rid of your current gas boiler altogether because the finances made sense. The business case was there to do so. That's the formation of Hot Green, and that's the concept, the core idea behind it that really drives us forward.
What an amazing story. There's so many questions that I have immediately. So how close are you to ultimate affordability?
In terms of ultimate affordability, we're actually doing pretty well. We're early stage. So we started last year. We've just actually finished the build and commissioning of our demonstrator, which is like a small lab scale. And in essence, what we're doing is...
I too am a nerd about these things. Mine happens to be a bit more logistics. I'm obsessed with logistics. But...
Okay. That's for another day.
I know. I love finding the sexy in unsexy. And that's exactly what this is, isn't it?
Yes, and that is 100% what I am also trying to do as a founder, is trying to make industrial heat sexy, because I think it's something that feels very inherently unsexy.
I know. We need a whole other conversation after this. But let's talk, because there's so many interesting things about doing that, and carrot and stick being one of them, I think.
Yes.
But anyway, tell me about where you're up to with your, because you're innovating, I guess, all the time, right?
We decided that a business model wasn't going to be sufficient to create affordability. So there's a few others in the space who have thought, well, what if you pay the cost of the heat pump off over 10 years and you put in some, you know, smart kind of financial wrappers and things like that onto it? And we realized that these were plasters to the core issue, which is around how much the system costs up front and how expensive it is to run. So how much are those factories paying in terms of their now electricity bill running off to power a heat pump, as opposed to what was previously their fossil fuel bill, their gas bill that they were paying. We had to innovate. We took apart the heat pump. We identified that there was actually one component, which is the compressor, which is, it's 40% of the cost of the equipment itself, but it's actually 80 to 90% impact in terms of that operating expense. I think of it a little bit as the lead singer in a band. Like, if you think of some of like the big bands of all time, everyone thinks about the lead singer. And the reality is, like, if the drummer switched out or the bass guitarist switched out, no one would care really too much. People get a bit angry when they listen sometimes and they name their favorite drummer or guitarist. But most people, the band is kind of really dictated by that, you know, often that lead singer. The compressor is the lead singer of a heat pump in the same
precious, you know, difficult.
It's precious, it's difficult, it's expensive, it has the highest salary, but it also is the difference between what really makes that band either, you know, more of your kind of something that no one's really heard of in the back end of YouTube, or whether it's the one of the greatest of all time. We are developing a compressor, which we're aiming to be, you know, the greatest of all time. The Mick Jagger of compressors. We essentially have been able to take a compressor type that already exists, that's ultra expensive, so expensive, but super, super efficient. Like, it has crazy high efficiencies. It's gorgeous in that way. And we figured out a way to make it really, really affordably. So it was a manufacturing innovation. We pride ourselves in not doing any crazy scientific breakthroughs, but in just doing smart engineering. And so we're able through that to pair ultra high efficiencies and affordability together. And it's that upfront affordability combined with efficient system, which means then lower energy bills for your factory in the long term, which is kind of our unique source.
Mm. You're at the beginning of your journey. So storytelling is obviously, because of how you talk, storytelling is baked into what you do, because you need to make industrial heat sexy. And that involves telling stories. How much of legislation do you think is going to drive what you do? I know that's a big nut to crack, but so there's this carrot and stick, and it's happened in automotive, hasn't it? Right. So you've been given targets. We are all, you know, and I know they keep extending them, but everyone has to have an EV by 2030. I think it's now 2035. Yeah. I can't remember. There's the element of ultimate affordability, which means I'd be a fool not to own a hot green pump because it's better for my business and it's better for the planet. But how much do you think there will be legislation that comes into this that so the carrot and the stick will come into play? And is the government, are governments aware of it? Yeah, is my other part, I guess.
It's definitely accelerated by government support with any of these aspects and particularly early stage innovation. It would be amazing if we could get some government, you know, anyone, shout out to anyone listening who might be MPs. UK government. I have to date, my co-founder who's just installed a domestic heat pump in his home has realised more government funding than our startup that's trying to build the next major industrial heat pump opportunity. And I think as the country that created the first steam engines, we should be leading here in terms of creating the next kind of steam systems generated by electricity, you know, leading in that industrial revolution, but also now leading in terms of the climate revolution of technology. That's my shameless plug.
No, it's not shameless because it benefits
for
not
anyone,
just you,
we'd,
right?
We'd love some, we'd love some more government support. You asking in terms of like, where are we at? What's our stage?
Mm-hmm.
We're venture backed. So we came from a venture builder, Deep Science Ventures. So we are going on a pathway of raising money from investors so that we can then use that to develop our technology to a point where we can start being commercial and then being able to grow off the back of that. We're building really large, heavy pieces of metal here. We can't just do it with a small investment from my savings pot, sadly. What has been great about that journey is we've been able to bring on some really awesome investors who are able to add extra strings to our bow and support us in other ways beyond just the money in the bank, which is always a nice thing as well as an early stage company.
Amazing. And I just, before we jump into all things dangerous, I just wonder, I know you're not all female, and we made that point very clearly up front that all female, you know, front businesses are even worse founded than female general, sorry, climate tech, worse than other ones. And I know your business partner is a man, so that's great. But are you doing different things differently on your investment journey because you're a woman? Do you find people reacting to you differently, or hopefully not?
I think it's so hard to know.
Yeah.
I mean, I've not done in the investment journey as a man, so I can't I can't make that comparison. I try and use it as an advantage. I always think there's two sides to every coin. And naturally you're going to end up with some negative discrimination, you're going to end up with some positive discrimination. And I think I have actually, on balance, ended up with more positive opportunities that have arisen. There's a few times where you have a call where you have to kind of shrug something off, or, you know, maybe you kind of are left a little bit wondering. Because I went into the year, obviously, I've known the stats for many years in terms of the amount of funding that goes into female-founded businesses in the UK, or even to mixed-gender teams, founding teams. And the statistics are pretty horrible. They're really off-putting. But I think often when you start to break it down into actually the number of female founders out there asking for capital versus male founders out there asking for capital, the numbers of just asking before even receiving that capital is still really low. And I think it can be a real advantage to be memorable. I go to a lot of conferences, and you can imagine the industrial heat space, what you have in your mind in terms of the kind of male-dominated, mostly in, you know, imagine you go to conference, male dominated, and someone's at a stand and they meet 20 people that day and exchange business cards. Say 19 of them were in a navy or a black suit, and 20 of, you know, of those 19, maybe two of them were called Brad, another two called Keith, our friend.
Yeah,
Keith.
Yeah, let's go, Keith.
One of them is in a bright green suit and is called Georgia and is a young woman in her 30s. The reality is, when all 20 of those individuals the next day follow up, the conversation that you're far more likely to remember is the one with the person who was a bit different.
Yeah.
And so whilst that can sometimes feel as a negative thing, I think actually in this world whereby you're trying to really punch above your weight in terms of impact, where I have a very, very minimal marketing budget, that ability to stand out, to be different, to be memorable, I think is really, really valuable. And I think it's something that definitely in my early career, I tried to hide, I tried to blend in much more. And now I'm trying to lean into it a lot more. I realize that industrial heat can be feminine. And sometimes people actually are quite perhaps bored of hearing the similar angle all the time on these sectors. And even, you know, the majority of the people that I interact with or engage with are men. They also appreciate that more feminine approach sometimes. Yeah. You know, just because they're all men, it doesn't mean that they want to hear or listen to another man. You know, they sometimes enjoy a different angle to the conversation.
You know, you're not the first woman on the podcast. It's come up a few times as that power of being different and recognizing it, and clothes actually, which feels, it's sort of almost counterintuitive to feminism in a lot of ways, isn't it? Like, I dress to impress the room, whatever that impress looks like. It could be jeans and a t-shirt, you know, it could be anything. But it feels counterintuitive to the years of the fight that women have had. But it is such a powerful thing and that men don't have, is that we can put on an armor that makes us look different to everybody else. And men tend to conform to a uniform, whether it's a suit or chinos and a shirt, blue shirt, you know, they tend to look quite similar, whereas we can use it. And even I interviewed Lisa Quest from Oliver Wyman, where you used to be, and she talks about her day glow suits that she wears. Her husband teases that she looks like a highlighter. That is a very conscious decision that she has made to stand out in a male dominated boardroom. So I love how counterintuitive yet how powerful it can be, and it's sort of a woman's superpower, I think. So I kind of enjoy that. So I couldn't agree with you more. Telling fresh stories from different perspectives is the future, I think, and that's why DE&I is so important, which is not what we're necessarily going to touch on today. But you know, the fact that it's being underwritten a bit is depressing to me. It's absolutely vital for the future of the planet. Do you consider yourself to be dangerous? I think clothes have nicely led us into that. Yeah. And how important is it for women to be dangerous today, do you think, Georgia?
I've been reflecting on this loads when thinking about coming onto the pod today. Engineers, we take health and safety extremely seriously. So let me add that small print first of all, because we do work with dangerous materials at times. I think I'm not dangerous at all if you want to work with me. I think if you are a boiler company, but you're now looking to include a load of, you know, industrial heat pumps and in your offering, then I'm not dangerous at all. I think I'm extremely dangerous if you do not want to work with me, because I am pretty unyielding in my ambition to deploy as many industrial heat pumps as possible. And in doing so, whilst we are working with boilers in the meantime, we need to create hybrid systems. We need to support a staggered approach to the transition. I think I'm enormously dangerous if you intend to continue to sell your fossil fuel powered boilers for the next 25 years and beyond.
I think that's one of the best answers we've ever had. We talk a lot about big D dangerous and little D dangerous. Big D dangerous being health and safety. You know, you don't want to mess with that. That is, you know, that is sacrosanct. I work quite a lot in the industrial recycling industry as well, actually. And they have the same thing. They're all a little bit uncomfortable about being taught because it's dangerous, right? They're crushing things. but they are little D dangerous because they're also a huge part of the circular economy. And that requires telling a new narrative. And that's exactly what I think you're doing. And you're constantly pushing, which, you know, is dangerous because you are butting up against something every day that you're having to break through, I think. So well done. Good answer. And I think, you know, also being a female engineer, working in that space, that sort of has a little D dangerous aspect to it as well. And particularly in climate tech, I think, which you've said is even more male than other areas of engineering. And does that come with its own battles? You've talked about standing out, but I wondered if there's been battles with that been in your engineering career path.
This is one of the reasons that often when you meet another female engineer, we benefit from a sisterhood that somewhat forms, because there is moments throughout your career, even from the first moments that I got into Cambridge, where people would say, oh, it's because they needed more girls to you know, in their programs. Or, oh, you know, you're working your first job on a factory floor and people say, oh, you're only able to get that job done because you're a woman. And, you know, the implication being that the men on the factory floor were more willing to do what they were told or asked to do because you're a woman. There's obviously niggles that occur throughout a career as a female engineer. I think there's also many very positive benefits that occur. And so I think it comes back to my earlier point about the balance of the two when you're different. And sometimes you can't always take the good without the bad. I think there are moments that I recognize I've also had opportunities to be on panels or to be at events where I think I perhaps might not have had that opportunity if I had been a young man. But so it is that balance between the two. The one thing that I really set myself and told myself this year was actually I'm a major Taylor Swift fan.
Oh, Swiftie!
Which works with my intro in terms of, like, you know, of being 32. One of her great songs is this song called The Man. It goes, I'm so sick and tired of running as fast as I can, wondering if I could get there faster if I was a man. And I realised that I was wasting a lot of time wondering in my life. Investors, for example, say no all of the time to all sorts of startups for all sorts of reasons. And what I didn't want to do was, you know, say, for example, every investor who says no, maybe there's one in 50 whereby gender, or maybe one in, you know, one in 50 where gender was a factor, maybe unconsciously in their decision. What I didn't want to do was for every single one of those 50 where I got a no, be like, ah, it was because I was a woman, or was it because I was a woman? You know, wasting that time wondering. I just wanted to continue running as fast as I could and not stop. And so that was my ambition that I set this year, was like, I knew the statistics going in. I know it's a very male dominated space, but I didn't want to waste time wondering in addition to any discrimination that potentially you do face.
It's nice. That's very, have you heard of Mel Robbins, who's this quite famous psychologist who says, let them,
yes,
let them. Yeah. That's what you've found through Taylor. But let exactly them have their own problem. I'm doing me. Yeah. And I think there's another thing. And again, I don't know if it's curiously female or not. And I've done a lot of Amdram in my life. And there's one thing on stage is that in acting, you can give offence as the part, but you also have to take it. And I think sometimes women take offence when I can only speak from my experience. It's easy to take offence. And sometimes we should just let things brush off and keep running. As you're saying, you know, sometimes it's not meant to be given. So yeah. I think there's a lot in that that's very wise. But I love that. Yeah. Just keep running and don't let them. Let them be there. Yeah. You've got to focus on you.
And I've really benefited. So I'm in, starting improvised comedy.
Oh, amazing.
About 5 years ago, and really started taking it seriously probably about 2 years ago. And I have an amazing troupe who meet up every Thursday night.
Amazing.
They have also been incredibly generous and patient with me this last year, as I've not really been able to make all rehearsals given starting the new business. But they're an incredible team. I have learned so much from improv comedy that I've taken into the startup world. And I think the biggest learning for me is just being really comfortable with small failures in that daily life of, you know, I used to live a life where I'd have a call or conversation with someone and then I'd get off afterwards and I'd be like, oh God, I should have said this, or, oh, I should have given that slide. Well, that wasn't quite right. Or what did they think of me? Or all of these, this kind of the criticism in my head that would occur as a result of like small daily failures that would occur. And what improv is amazing at is, because you have to get up on a stage where you're given a prompt and you essentially have to create a scene, failure happens all the time. You have to move on. You've got to go on to the next scene. You can do a scene which is absolutely terrible and you just have to move on to the next scene, let it go. It's behind you, the thing that's in front of you, and you have to be just so present in the now. And I think that's massively helped me to get out of my head in that way and just be willing to chuck myself into different situations and know that I'm going to scramble my way out one way or another.
I mean, that's all about resilience as well, isn't it? Again and again, we've talked on this podcast about people doing either physical or mental, and actually stand-up improv is probably both physical and mental, challenges, because it bakes in resilience that you carry through with you to work. You know, the ability to get up and do it again is so important in work. So I think that's really interesting. So you're practicing resilience, I think. You're honing your resilience. And also, just, I've got to give a shout out, because I used to work with an agency called Peppercom, which is a New York PR agency, and their CEO, who I'm not sure if he's CEO anymore, so sorry, Steve Cody, if you still are, he is a stand-up comedian, and they give stand-up comedy training to everybody in the company and some of their clients for all those reasons that you've just talked about. It's about honing messaging. Yeah. It's about learning to act, you know, think on your feet. It's about it's about not sweating the small stuff. It's about keeping running. And so, yeah, I know. Yeah, brilliant. So I'm going to make sure they hear this podcast, because, that's amazing.
I also shout out to Keith McCabe, our mutual friend, because he's someone who really taught me that resilience is a muscle. It's not a trait. It's something, I think sometimes people think, oh, you're born resilient. You know, this person was born really hardy, but it's something that you very much continue to work on and to strengthen and to train, just in the same way as a muscle. And then you realize, you know, when you haven't been resilient for particularly long time. I have a few friends at the moment whose parents are now entering into retirement, having pretty easy lives, and then, you know, a small hiccup occurs in the planning for something like their wedding day, and their parents just can't cope anymore. A really lovely year of no problems happening, and then suddenly a problem happens. So you also can lose it if you're not kind of training it on a regular basis.
But absolutely. But equally, and everybody, you can be really resilient. You can fall off the resilient log. But by the way, you can get back on it again. You can do things at times.
Totally.
So, you know, we're all allowed dips and phases. But don't, you know, it is a, like a muscle, it can get weak and strong again. So just always remember that too.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you, I think, and it's sort of based off all of this, but we live in a world that's been created by men. It just is, just because of dint of history. We just have. I mean, things are changing, and we're going through a period of very rapid transformation, which I think is really excited. But how, and you are sitting, you know, you're trying to solve one of the world's perennial issues, which is climate change, or not perennial now, pressing issues. How important are women to be part of changes like those? And do you think they bring new ways of thinking and new solutions? And not just what Hot Green is doing, but more widely.
So critical. We need the absolute best minds to be solving problems that can help mitigate the worst impacts of climate change at the moment. To get the best minds, that includes both men and women. I think you are correct. We have to date lived in a world that has been dominantly designed for men by men. And we need to shift into a world that has been designed by both men and women, for both men and women. And that's the shift that we need to do. And I think to help enable that, we absolutely, with regards to the climate tech community, would hugely benefit from more women entering the space. I think one of the things that I really try and do is to make it approachable, simplify the technical language, because I often find that men are more willing to shift careers into technology, having not had a technology background. Whilst I think women are concerned that if they haven't got a technology background, even if they're technologically curious and interested in the space, are less willing to make that leap. And I greatly encourage all women, whatever their skills. There are so many different skill sets that we need at the moment in scaling climate technologies. And we actually already have so many of the technologies already exist. It's just about how do we get them to scale? How do we use communication and marketing or sales to really be able to scale these technologies and start making a significant impact?
I couldn't agree. Yes, it's not always about invention, is it? Sometimes it's about opportunity. I don't know whether women or men, both, but we need, all of us, eyes need to be wide open, our blinkers off, to just see where those opportunities are. And we're often so blinkered, aren't we, and how things have always been done, that we forget to turn our heads from side to side and look where things might fit. And just with that in mind, we've talked about women and men, and I know I'm always aware when I'm on this podcast that, you know, I'm a very privileged woman, and we talk about male privilege. I definitely have female privilege. There's no two ways about it. You do too. We've come from a very comfortable lifestyle, and that's not our fault. It's just who we are. Luckily, we're awake to it and we know what's happening. But I think, and I've talked about this again and again, diversity is about men and women, but it's also about people from different demographic backgrounds. It's about different ethnicities. It's about different genders and sexualities. It's about all of those things at once. And I just wondered, where do you think engineering is on that spectrum? How good is it at that really blended view of the world? Which is, by the way, how I think we're going to solve the world's problems, because, you know, we can't look from, you know, an African farmer's perspective. We just can't.
Beyond the obvious gender, perspective, yeah. because I think we've spoken enough.
Yeah.
Engineering, 20% women.
We know. It's not
beyond the gender. I actually think engineering's pretty good.
Yeah.
And when you compare it to, you know, something like being a doctor or a barrister, whereby you have to have studied however many years and gone to a particular university to then become a doctor or a barrister or a lawyer, whatever it might be. Engineering, it's a really broad church. So I call myself an engineer and, you know, I was really fortunate. I studied at Cambridge. I had kind of 4 amazing years of education there. But then I went into business and I joke with my co-founder, I am far more likely to be struck by lightning than a moment of thermodynamics wizardry. There are also other engineers out there who are really brilliant hands-on engineers. Like, you know, I'm a practical person, but when it came to actually in the lab, I don't get my hands dirty with the spanners and the screws too often. We have other members of our team who do that. But there are amazing engineers who are much less academic and much more on intuition.
Yeah.
And maybe have only done, they might have done an apprenticeship and that be their route into it. Or there are people that are now transitioning from totally different careers into doing a 4-month heat pump installation course. And they can call themselves engineers. And I think what I like about the term engineer is it is a broad church. You don't have to necessarily be chartered or have a degree in order to call yourself an engineer. It's just more about the role that we play in society in terms of building and fixing things.
Love that. Love that. That's great. We've talked on this podcast before about the exponential effect climate change has on women in particular. And I think when you dig into it more, it becomes more obvious. It doesn't feel very obvious at first for most people, especially I think in emerging economies. And I wonder, do you agree with that? Does that drive you with Hot Green? Is it exciting that the problems that you're solving might help women more? I wonder how you, or is it not something you think about? You're thinking more just about the climate.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you're right. I think it is. Sometimes you don't end up always making that connection day to day when you're looking at something that's trying to reduce carbon emissions. But it is so important in terms of the long term. You know, women are far more likely to be in something like farming or to not have the capabilities to migrate to better economic opportunities, and so are therefore way worse impacted. So yeah, it's definitely adds to that broader motivation.
In series 3, we talked to Lindsay Bass, who's company Impactor Global invests in Southern Hemisphere infrastructure projects. And one of their driving purposes is because climate change affects women more acutely. And even if they're talking about bridge building or road building, the impact on that on the women in those communities will be exponentially greater than it is on the men. So it's an interesting callback to what we're talking about now. So is Hot Green's purpose is what you said at the moment, to get affordable industrial heat pumps in to lessen the impact on climate change? It's a very clear mission and purpose.
Yeah, it's to save plants money and save factories money while cutting carbon. It's that duality. We can't cut carbon at any cost is the reality, because if we started to do that, if industrial factories, industrial plants, if they were just to adopt solutions which weren't economically viable, then the price of your milk is going to go up. The price of a pint is going to go up. And we're already in a cost of living crisis at the moment in the UK. And so this is about how can we create a scenario whereby it's actually more affordable to make the goods that we consume whilst also not doing it at the cost of our planet.
Georgia, what do you wish you could tell the younger you about the power of being dangerous? What advice would you give yourself that would have helped you on your journey that you've reached today? Also, you're 32, so you've still got a lot of your career ahead of you. That's not young. I don't, because it's not. That's very patronising. But you've still got at least half of your career ahead of you, haven't you? So
You know, there's an obvious one, which is to tell my 19 and 20-year-old self to pay more attention in thermodynamics.
Because
it's actually going to play a large, quite substantial role in your future.
Yeah.
So that would be the obvious one. But I was just actually thinking, I have a few mantras that I have learned probably over the last decade or so that I scribble. I have these pens, the glass pens behind me, and I scribble them onto my mirror, on the inside of my mirror. And so whenever I'm like having a moment, I just kind of remind myself of those mantras. One of the most important to me is you only get to live life once, so live your life. Mm. I think that's really important. I spent a lot of my earlier years and career trying to mirror or echo the behaviors of others and taking advice that actually didn't feel authentic or natural to myself or how I would respond to a situation. And there's obviously some of that in a learning experience that you do, but I think I've now got a far greater sense as to utilizing a bit of my instinct as well as to what feels right and wrong. I got long COVID in 2021.
Oh, yeah.
So I had a moment in my life where I couldn't walk to the end of my street. I was sleeping for most of the hours of the day. And that really taught me a lot about various aspects of my life, because I went from being an incredibly busy, high-performing individual in management consultancy, which is a very intense career, to lying horizontal all day long. And I suddenly had to decouple the busyness being your value. I often, you know, people say, how are you? And I'll be like, busy, busy.
That's not you. Yeah.
You know, that's not how you are. That's how you know, what you are right now.
Yeah.
And I think having to decouple that, there was a lot of, for me, of focus on energy management as opposed to time management. I was always like, how can I be as productive as possible? But actually really focusing on your energy, on how you rest and recover, was something that was really key. It's a mantra that I now live a lot by is dare to be average. I'm a recovering perfectionist. And if I had the time, I probably would be a perfectionist. You know, I would be prepping for months ahead of this podcast being like, how do we have the greatest, highest performing podcast of all time? Or how do I have the greatest meeting, whatever it is? And I have this now mantra, which is dare to be average. And there are some things where you just have to accept, you know, you dare to be average at this. Be an average friend. Be an average daughter. Be average in this meeting.
Because average is good. Really good, right? So it depresses me beyond belief that average has become a negative word, which it has, right? Oh, that's average kind of means that's bad. And it does not. And I was a governor for a big all-inclusive state school for 7 years. And the push for children to get above average results was so strong. And why are we forcing children to think that doing well isn't good enough?
Yeah.
So I could not agree with you more. And you're in line with Sheryl Sandberg, you know, Facebook fame, who's just like, sometimes you've got to say good enough, because because moving forward is more important than one moment of perfection. So you've learned that very early. Again, I don't want to be patronizing, but brilliant. What a brilliant insight to have now and not when you're in your 50s, which is kind of when I had mine. So amazing. Yeah. Average manifesto, like absolutely. It's okay. Well done.
For most people, they're average. I mean, I say this coming from a...
Yes, perfectionist Cambridge background.
there's a phrase for it, which is insecure overachiever.
Yeah.
Which is for people like myself who might have been top performer at school, gone to top performing universities, gone on to careers at kind of...
Yes, top performing brand, yeah.
Yeah, top performing brands. Some of those top performing brands, less so all of mine, but some play on the insecure overachiever because you're constantly trying to push for better. And there's a moment where you have to say, you know what, I'm just going to dare to be average at this thing. I'm going to do this set of slides average, I'm going to build this website average, or whatever it might be. There are just things where you have to pick and choose what are the things you're going to be pretty average at, so that you can make space and time for either you to rest and do some of that energy management, or for you to really thrive at something else.
Obviously, the obvious elephant in the room on this one is everybody's average is a little different as well. So it's the average for you. But so I wonder, with that in mind and talking about young people, what would you tell other young women looking to get into career paths that are traditionally seen as male, I guess particularly STEM?
Do it.
Yeah.
Why not? It's great fun.
That's easy. Just do it. The other thing that I loved on your LinkedIn is you tell a story of travel, that you've traveled a lot and that you've been very adventurous. Do you think that's fueled your dangerousness? Do you think that's fueled the kind of person you are at work today?
I definitely have a sense of adventure. You know, I would be terrible in a job that was monotonous.
Mm-hmm.
I would be awful. You know, my partner gets so frustrated sometimes because we'll be there on a Sunday and he'll be relaxing and having a nice time. And I'll be like, what are we doing next? What are we doing next? You know, what's the activity? I really am someone who loves kind of constant adventure. You know, that's come out in a bit of a travel bug in my younger years. But it's also was great for me in consulting because you're constantly doing different things. I love it with the hat I wear now because I sit here because we're early stage. I'm our CEO, but I'm also our CFO. I'm our chief marketing officer, our chief strategy, our, you know, leading in on the investment front, but I'm also doing the admin.
You're the PA as well.
Yeah, I'm the PA. I'm booking the meetings. I'm literally the person who's cycling to the poster shop the day before we're meant to be a conference to pick up the banners, like whatever it is, like you take it on. And I adore that variety. So I think that sense of adventure is very much something that does then drive your career to want that adventure within the work that you do, to have that different conversations, to have a job where you get to meet and engage with an amazing community of other people.
I love that idea of adventurous work. It's exploring your mind as well as it's sort of exploring what's out there, isn't it? And how much you can flex yourself to deliver everything you need to do. All right, we're going to go on to advice on channeling dangerousness, because I often ask my guests about how they tackle some of the more male constructs at work, and things like, you know, in networking and in asking for a pay rise, which a lot of women find difficult. But I think because you're in the midst of, you're such an early stage of your business, I wondered if we could ask some questions around that, if that's okay.
Yeah.
So I wondered, what would you be your top three tips for starting your own business?
Oh, okay. I think tip number one would be know what the risks are. It actually takes some work sometimes to figure out what those risks are, but your job is really to go on a journey of de-risking that. So if you've got a product and you think customers will love it, go and talk to those customers first to actually understand what they want. If you've got a particular way you're manufacturing that product, have you talked to manufacturers? Can you manufacture it yourself? I think a lot of people in startups think that you have to have this crazy moment where you go like, oh, I'm leaving university and not graduating. You know, I'm dropping out of Harvard, or I'm leaving my high paid job. I'm going to take this massive risk. But actually now I really encourage people to say, well, what could you do? Could you go down to 4 days a week on your current job and try something out for that other day, and do some of the big de-risking? You'll never be able to tackle all the risks or de-risk things, but there are certain things that you can do. And especially in that first year of your business, trying to figure out each of those, what are the major risks, and the ones that are in your control, what are the steps that you need to do to de-risk that, I think is super important. Particularly in this modern world, my second piece of advice would be understand the old playbook, but use first principle thinking. And this is because so much is changing right now, particularly with AI, which I know gets mentioned probably on 99% of podcasts at the moment.
Yeah.
But it is really changing the way that business is being done. And the way that somebody started their business 10 years ago is going to be completely different to how you can start a business today, with things like, you know, vibe coding your website, or reaching out to customers, or using LinkedIn. All of these different platforms are emerging, and the way of doing business is evolving accordingly. Understand the old playbook, know why that was the way of doing things, but also look at the cards in front of you today, build your business accordingly with them. A third thing would be growth is inherently uncomfortable.
Okay.
I think fundamentally, if you were growing, there are pains with it. I think you have to get comfortable with being uncomfortable. And if you're not uncomfortable, you either have an amazing mindset, which I don't.
Maybe psychotic.
Or
yes.
You're not growing fast enough for what you could be doing. And I think just getting really steady with that. And then if I'm allowed a fourth one.
Okay, cheat, one in. But yes.
which kind of comes back to this energy management piece, but I think growing a business is a marathon, not a sprint in most cases. I think sometimes we can get absorbed in this, particularly on LinkedIn at the moment, there's a real tech bro culture of what's called 996, which is working 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. 6 days a week. I don't do that. I take weekends. I do often end up working some weekends, but some weekends I don't. And I think it's really important to find that rest and balance across your week, especially when you're starting something that needs to sustain and be longer than a 3-month project.
And also, if you don't take that R&R period, all my best ideas and thinking come from when I'm not actually doing the work. And I think all leaders of all companies, the best leaders, give themselves that space to ideate. And again, Lisa Quest on the podcast that I did with her last series takes, I think it's 6 weeks or a month off every summer, and she goes back to Canada, and she goes to the lakes, and she says that's almost her fuel, her creative fuel for the year ahead, because the ideas can bubble in that.
Totally.
Yeah, they're fertilised, aren't they, in that environment. Brilliant. Four top tips. And again, I was going to ask about three top tips when seeking funding.
My first one is about don't underestimate the power of stories. This is the storytelling that we were talking about at the very beginning of this pod. You would be amazed at how much people focus on getting like a really neat set of slides that don't tell a coherent story. And I would really spend time creating a really clear vision of what you want the company to be. And if you can create and that really clear vision in your mind, not only do you communicate it really effectively, but you actually create such a strong inherent belief that it's going to occur.
You manifest,
you can do that.
Yeah.
You manifest it. Yeah. You do that visualization that, you know, so many sports teams are now doing or high performance podcasts are talking about. But it's genuinely real, because if you can create that conviction and you can tell that story, then other people will get behind you. And there's so much. Investors love to think that they do a lot on all these different metrics and they have all sorts of frameworks as to why they invest. But actually, there's a lot of value in gut as well. Mm. And a lot of that gut comes from someone's conviction and their ability to tell that compelling story and their belief that it's not just an idea. This is the start of a long-term journey that they're going on.
There is science behind the gut as well. And again, it was on a previous podcast with Rebecca Hurst, who is CMO of EY, who has done a whole piece of work into the vagus nerve, which literally connects your gut to your brain. So there is an app. So the gut is a very smart organ. Mm. Very smart organ.
Very smart. The second is to, for investors, what I found is really important is to like understand their game. So understand the game of investors. The challenge with investors getting kind of VC capital, is kind of mostly what I've been focused on, is you go on their websites and they will say, we support early stage founders. We invest in climate tech ideas. No. What they do is they take other people's money, they invest it in your business to get a return for the other people's money and take a cut themselves. Like that is fundamentally what they do. And unless you understand that game of what size of investments are they making, how much return does each of those investments, do they need to believe each of those investments will make? Like, is that 10x? Is that 100x? Mm. Does it need to return the fund? What's the typical proportion that they take? What stage do they invest in? Unless you understand that game, it's really hard to identify the right investors for your business, because it's a real two-way matching process and you can end up getting a lot of no's that someone might think you've got a brilliant idea, but you just don't fit within their thesis, or the train that you're on is not leaving at the right time or is not going at the right speed that they're looking to match up with. That's super critical, is really understand the investment game. And then the final thing is simplification is really powerful. Maybe this is a bit of a cheat and links back to the first one a little bit in terms of storytelling. When I first started talking to investors, you know, you have this bias that you want to sound smart. And so you think, oh, I want to sound intelligent, and therefore I'll use long words and complicated, you know, utilize, go into the technical details of the solution and so forth. And I think actually something that I found to be quite a rare skill in investors, and some of the investors that we've been able to bring on have this skill, which is this ability to say, I don't know, or I don't understand. And to, you know, could you explain this to me further? The reason there's a kind of the worst stereotype of an investor is ones who sit there and they say, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Like nodding along as if they understand all the technical detail. And then at the end of it, they pass on your solution because they fundamentally didn't understand, but they'll give you another reason. They won't say, the reason I'm passing is because I don't understand. I'm passing because of X, Y, Z, or you're too early, or you don't have this. And so even though we sometimes fear that we sound super at risk of sounding stupid ourselves, I've really worked to try and simplify the language that we use, the way that we explain our core concepts, so that everyone, their auntie, their uncle, their dog could get on board in terms of what we're up to, and that we have this clear baseline of communication accordingly. So those are my three.
Amazing. Really practical and useful stuff. Yeah, simplicity and connection, I think, is everyone. You need to connect with the people in the room for them to be able to want to buy or invest in you, don't you? So absolutely vital. So dangerous networks. All dangerous women have a phalanx of people behind them who are supporting them or who they turn to. Who are your three most dangerous mentors, do you think? And we've had loads of cheats in this, so I'm waiting for more cheats.
Okay. I'll stick to three for this one. Yeah. So you know, shout out here for Keith McCambridge.
Okay, amazing. One. His head is going to be very big after this podcast.
Just the fundamental thing I really learned from him was he lives and breathes this, which is around moving from performance management, which is all about, you know, how do you manage the team that are around you? How do you ensure that people are turning up on time and doing their work and so forth, to performance enablement, which is all about how do you create the best environments, the best cultures, the best support for people to thrive. And I think for me, he was the first manager who really did that in my career, who really enabled me to shine in that way and really support my growth accordingly. So he's both an amazing accelerator in my career, but also has kind of taught me so much in terms of management style and being willing to lead with heart and not put on a professional veneer at all times, but actually to, you know, show vulnerability and be human and connect with people. The second is Serena Wiegman, who's football. The football England women's
Lioness
team coach,
yeah.
Won three successive Euros finals, which is an enormous achievement. I think it's just clear from her team that she's so well respected. She is clearly very well liked, and she also makes hard decisions. There's a lot of, you know, decisions going into the Euros this year, which caused a lot of controversy online, actually really paid off, were the right decisions for the team. And yeah, I just have a lot of respect for her for that reason.
She's also unashamedly herself at all times.
Yeah,
I know.
Absolutely. Mm. And then I think the final one, I said I was a Taylor Swift fan, so I'm going to have to finish with Taylor Swift.
Amazing.
I think she has redefined the music industry, the entertainment industry. She has done things which others have never done before. She doesn't follow the typical playbook, and she is somewhat fearless in the way that she approaches things. I am just constantly inspired by her lyrics, inspired by her work ethic, the amount of content that this woman manages to produce, and she continues to keep us all entertained. So yeah, those would be my three.
Amazing. And Taylor also thinks with the blinkers off. So all that, I can't remember, you know, on the recent world tour, you know, every city she went to, she put food in their food bank. She donated, you know, just is that 360 holistic thinking, which also makes her so stand out, I think, just a moment.
Yeah, yeah.
An excellent three, Georgia. Thank you.
Thank you.
So now, before we close, how do people find out more about you, about Hot Green? Where's the best online spaces to find you?
Yeah,
and can you tell us the name of your improv troupe as well?
Oh, sure. So you can find us at www.hotgreensolutions.com.
Amazing.
Or on LinkedIn. Typical LinkedIn, just Hot Green Solutions. Myself, Georgia Ware, Georgia spelt like the country, Ware spelt like our phone warehouse. And then our improv troupe, we do historical themed improv. So we are called Hysterical, but spelt historical with an E.
Amazing.
Hysterical, I, and then an E. And you can find us, I'm not on Instagram, but if you are, it's at Hysterical Improv on Instagram. And we have a show on our Christmas show. I think it's the 30th of November. So please do come along if you're in London.
Well, Georgia, thank you so much for joining us. I think it was worth the wait. So thank you.
Worth the wait, indeed.
Worth the wait. And we will see you soon, Georgia.
Well, thank you so much, Sophie, for having me on. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Well, what a brilliant conversation with the equally brilliant Georgia Ware. I just learned so much. My mind is a bit blown, whether it's about industrial heat, which everybody, we all need to look into more. I mean, that's a 10, 20% that we should be saving straight away, to the insights that she gave us as a startup, to the incredibly powerful storytelling and how consciously she's creating her own narrative. Georgia just seems to be across it all. I think that's a 101 for anyone starting their own business, whether it's female-led or not. And oh, by the way, loving how she uses her femininity as a superpower whilst also understanding she is like everybody else out there. So what an episode. Loved it. And if you loved it, and I hope you did, then why do let us know? Well, please comment, like, share, even subscribe to the Dangerous Women podcast. We love to know that you are listening to us and part of our incredible community. Meanwhile, tune in next time. And as always, we dare you to listen.